Hello and welcome to episode number 399. This is the Project Management Podcast at pm-podcast.com and I am Cornelius Fichtner. The one thing I really like about project management is how unpredictable my days can sometimes be. I come to the office in the morning with a clear plan of what we are going to do today, and then something happens. Maybe something breaks, a critical resource is unexpectedly not available today, or even more normal, the customer wants a change, and of course he wants it today. I love this challenge because as a project manager, I now have to re-evaluate the situation and change my plans accordingly. That is situational project management. If you are a project manager who wants to become PMP or PMI ACP certified, then the easiest way to do so is with our sister podcasts, the PM Prepcast or the Agile Prepcast, and study for the exam by watching the in-depth exam prep video training from pmprepcast.com. However, there is more to situational project management than just responding with a knee-jerk reaction. These times demand situational awareness, skill, and finesse from us project managers. And so I'm very happy to welcome Oliver Lehmann, who literally wrote the book on this topic. The book is called Situational Project Management: The Dynamics of Success and Failure. And now, please get situated. Enjoy the interview.
The Project Management Podcasts feature interview.
Today with Oliver Lehmann, project management trainer, speaker, coach, and author.
Hallo Oliver, recht herzlich willkommen.
Hallo Cornelius, schön mal wieder bei dir zu sein.
So, to begin, let's define what we are going to be discussing in this interview. What is your definition of situational awareness?
Situational awareness builds on a very simple observation. The same tools, the same practices, the same behaviors, the same approaches that are successful in one project situation may fail in another one. So if we rely on simple best practices, they may sometimes match the situation and be the right thing to do, and sometimes they lead into disaster. So we should always ask ourselves, am I doing the right thing for the right situation, the right moment, the right environment, context in which we are, and so on.
And then what do we mean by situational project management?
Situational project management begins with this same observation, the same thing that can lead to success in one project or in a specific situation in a project may fail in another one. But we want to do a bit more on that. We want to understand what are the practices, what are the specific tools maybe, what are approaches that match a given situation. If we understand the situation, we can select the right practices to manage these situations. And my book tries to give some help in that. It has still some open questions there, because I think we haven't fully understood how situation project management in all situations works. But I think I can give help for many situations already, based on some research together with a group of experts, based on my experience with over 20 years in project management training, and before that, over 12 years in practicing project management.
And let me guess, if I'm not planning my project and I'm just improvising from moment to moment, that has nothing to do with situational project management, right?
It may have to do with that sometimes, because you have situations where planning is impossible, or where planning may be too much planning may be detrimental for your project, because sometimes the way is made by walking. There are project situations where you cannot do a lot of planning. You just have to do the project step by step, and with each step you make a new decision where to go to. You develop something, and during this development you have some results, and then you make new decisions based on these results, and so on. There are project situations where this is the right approach, like driving in the fog with a car, for instance. it's a very similar situation. But then you have situations where you can look far into the future of your project, like on a road where you can see a long distance ahead of you, and you can do a lot of long-term plans, and they can just come together. Sometimes it has to do with situational project management.
All right. So that's situational awareness and situational project management. Are there any other related terms that we should be aware of before we get started?
Yeah, there is one term that I have found very helpful here, and I call it navigating between two monsters. I think project management in many dimensions is a process where we have something extreme on the right and something extreme on the left. Think of project management when you look into the future. That's just the topic we just had. Can I do long-term predictions, or do I need to go for more agile methods, which work with the short-term decisions and with sprints and these things? And navigating between two monsters means we start somewhere in the middle, and from time to time we have to move more to the left, maybe to the agile side, and other times more to the predictive side. So we should be able to adjust our behavior to that. There are many other questions like that. Do we need to take a strong stance in a given situation? Or is it better to be more soft and more acceptable what other people want from us? Do we need to be heroes and single fighters? Or are we more collaborative and more integrated in a group? And there are many other questions like that. And navigating between two monsters means rarely the good way to go is rarely the extreme way. We have to find a way somewhere in the middle between these extremes, and sometimes more turn to one side or to the other side. But balancing things out, that's a big art in project management, and that's something project managers should be able to do.
Okay. And you've pretty much also answered my next question, because I was going to ask you, can you give me a few more examples of situations where we need awareness and situational project management, like I gave in the introduction? Do you have anything more for us? When do we really need it?
We need it all the time, first of all. I think project managers are situational. Most of us do this somehow. They are not doing this methodologically. They do it by inspiration and by emotions and by feelings and by experience and all those things, by instinct maybe, all the things that drive project managers. And they know they have to adjust to given situations. But I have a very, very specific example. Just here in Germany, we had two major station projects, main station projects here in the last couple of years. One of those two was a great, great success. This was the Berlin main station. And there was a second one some years later running into deep troubles, deep crisis, which was the Stuttgart main station. And the interesting thing is it was run by the same organization, Deutsche Bahn, German Railway. It was run using the same approaches, the same methods. It's the same deliverable, more or less, that it brings out. It even was the same project manager, a guy from Egypt. And in one project, he was extremely successful. And in the other one, he ran the project into crisis. At one point in time, he had to leave the project, had to give up his position there. And so the interesting question is, what was different between those two projects, which made one project successful and the other one a failure, with the same approaches, with the same tools, the same methods, and so on? So that's my favorite example. And to give you the answer for those two projects, the Berlin main station was a greenfield project. It was the old death strip between East and West Berlin, where they had a lot of open space and just could build a station there without having to take too much care of stakeholders, of people living around. And Stuttgart was in the middle of a city, people living around, people afraid for their houses. This was where it started, because they had to drill tunnels under occupied neighborhoods in difficult geological areas. And people were afraid of their houses on top. They wanted to talk with the project manager, and he was not prepared to talk with them about their fears. And the problem is always when you have a lot of stakeholders and you just ignore them, they will come back and they will bring their friends with them and they will bring lawyers with them. And that's exactly what happened there. So The question is, first of all, how can we understand the situational requirements on project measures, which may be very different, even if it seemingly all looks the same? And the other thing we need to understand is, how do we need to adjust our approaches and our behaviors in the Stuttgart project and the crisis project? Intensive stakeholder management would have been extremely important. It was not that important in Berlin.
My next question is going into exactly the opposite side from situational awareness and situational project management. Do you have an example for us when we cannot be situational, where things are black and white and you just have to go one way or the other? Even as a very experienced project manager, situational project management does not apply in this situation.
There's one moment, I think, when you have to be very strict, very strong, when we have no gray shades or something like that. And that's when it's about your professional integrity, when it comes to questions of bribery, of corruption, of discrimination of people based on gender, on skin color, religion, or whatever it is. I think we have to be unsituational. I don't know if such a word exists. Yeah.
I'm not sure if that exists. Yeah.
But we have to be very clear and very strict and very, very straight in these situations. Yeah.
Okay. The companies that I worked for, they always had a clearly defined project management methodology. And that methodology told me what to do and when to do it. What considerations do we project managers have to make before we deviate from the prescribed methodology?
First of all, I was a trainer for this kind of methodologies for many years. Before I started as a PMP trainer with PMP preparation as a main business, I helped companies as an external trainer to teach their new methodologies to their team. So I know these methodologies quite well. I know their strengths and I know their weaknesses. There's one thing my project managers have to take care of. But these methodologies, if they are good methodologies, they provide a lot of support and a lot of help and make lives to some degree easier. But sometimes they don't really fit to the needs of the project. Maybe I remember one case, there was a methodology in an organization which was developed for a project of a certain size, a typical size that they had in this organization. And a project manager approached me and asked me, Oliver, I can't use this methodology that you trained to us. I cannot use it in a given project. Can you just come over and have a look at that? And they paid me a day just to have a look at their project. And it took me not even 5 minutes to agree with him, yeah, because his project was far too big for the methodology. It wasn't scalable enough for such a project. And I told him, make a note, put it into your project documentation, why you have to deviate from this methodology. You can say that you talked with me and that I agree to you. And at this very moment, you have a good explanation for that. 2 days later, I got a very angry phone call from the PMO manager of this organization. How can you do that? We hired you, we pay you that you help people use it, or that you bring people to use it, make people use the methodology, but you cannot tell people to deviate from that. We then had 10 minutes discussion on the details, and the PMO had agreed again. Yeah, it's okay. It's right there. So you have to have a good explanation if you deviate from a methodology. But if you have that as a project manager, your business and your profession is not to follow methodologies. It's to deliver successful projects without destroying the organization.
What about if we work in a controlled environment, for example, in a healthcare business or in a bank or insurance, where we have to follow externally imposed regulations?
I don't believe that outside of laboratories, there is such a thing as a controlled environment. Controlled environment is a glass tube. Yeah, it's in chemistry or somewhere else. The other thing is, of course, you have to meet requirements. And if you have legal requirements, if you have requirements from government agencies, maybe also internal organizational requirements to meet, then you have to meet them. That's very simple. If you have a deadline, you have to meet the deadline. If you have to have have funding available, then you at least have to try to do the project with the funding available. And if you have to meet legal requirements, you cannot be, you cannot have a project against the law.
All right. You already mentioned best practices earlier on. Best practices, many times, these are common sense recommendations that have helped many others before us to be successful in the past. When do we accept and when do we reject best practices for our project?
There is no such thing as a best practice for project management. There are best practices in operations where you do things again and again and again. Uh-huh. But if something is called a best practice, it may still be the second best or third best practice. So I'm still very careful with using such a word. But in project management, the same practice that is successful in one moment may fail in another one. I recently met a manager of a PMO from the electronics industry, and he told me, "We just moved all our projects to agile methods." And I thought, well, maybe for 30% of these projects or so, this may be a good decision. What about the other 70%? Yeah? He considers this now the best practice, and he thinks he has to have agile methods for the entire portfolio of their projects. And some of these projects need a lot of prediction. You need to book resources early. You have to order certain deliveries very early, because otherwise they will not be there on time. If you book people too late, someone else will book them in front, ahead of you, and they won't be available for you. In many projects, you have to do long-term predictions. So in some projects, it's good to move to agile, and in some projects, it's not.
What I'd like to do next is I would like to open up your book, Situational Project Management, The Dynamics of Success and Failure, and take a look at the tools that you have in there. You have 9 tools for situational project management in your book, and we want to review 4 of these. We discussed which 4 that we're going to take here. They're going to be benefit engineering, pressure-free estimating, protective change request management process, and then finally, situational project scheduling. So let's take a look at the first one, benefit engineering. What is it and how does it relate to situational project management?
Benefit engineering is a bit opposite of cost engineering. If you look into organizations, often we see that we have a budget and the budget is not enough. Maybe it was too small, or something went wrong in the project which was unexpected, or whatever it is, we need some additional money and we have a problem that this is not in the budget. By the way, an important part of the book, an important element of the book, is the distinction between customer projects and internal projects. If it is an internal project, the big question, of course, is the budget. If it is a customer project, the big question is how much is the customer prepared to pay to us, and some of this money must flow into a contractor's profit. So how much remains, how much money is remains as a kind of budget then as well for the customer project. In both cases, money may become a problem. I think in most projects, we know this situation that the budget is not sufficient, or we have problems with deadlines. By the way, in most projects, we don't have just one deadline. As you find in literature generally, we have lots of deadlines, not just one. And each deadline, missing a deadline, could be a problem on its own. So we may have a problem with time as well. We may have problems that we need more people, more time of these people maybe than originally planned. We will have disruptions of operations as a part of a project. We have to disrupt operations, and we may find out that instead of disrupting operations over 4 weeks, we may have to disrupt them over 8 weeks, and whatever it is. So there are maybe many situations in projects where we cannot really meet the requirements or the agreements made up front. And one way is to apply cost engineering to reduce costs or somehow speed up the project with fast tracking and with crashing and all these methods that we know. But there are limitations on that. In an internal project, you have to deliver something that was expected. In a customer project, the limitation is simply the contract. You don't want to breach the contract, and I hope most people don't want to be in breach of contract. So what are you going to do in such a situation? You could look on the other side and could look on the benefits. The prerequisite is that you have a very clear understanding in an internal project of the requester and the needs of the requester. It could be sponsor, could be users, whoever it is, could be a product department for whom you do some development. If you're in a customer project, it's the customer and the employees of the customer and so on. Maybe in a situation to give some additional benefits that were originally not planned. Benefit engineering means maybe you can convince your internal requester or your customer to accept additional cost, new defined deadlines and other things if you give them additional benefit on that. I think project managers are in a very good situation, typically in a very, very good situation to do benefit engineering because they see things that no one has seen for the last couple of years maybe. They touch things that have not been touched for years. And a modern organization is rarely a perfect system. It's more a combination of workarounds and of improvisations and of preliminary solutions that are expected to be replaced with a final solution later, and this never happens. So you find a lot of inefficiencies in organizations, often very costly inefficiencies there. And project managers are in a great situation, in a great position to help customers there. But of course, the customer or the internal requester will have to be prepared to accept maybe a higher price for the project or other dates or whatever the problem is here. So we can help the customer and help ourselves in situations of crisis. Whether in a given situation this is possible to do or not, and whether the customer will accept this or not, has one big prerequisite, and that is that you know your customer or in an internal project, the internal requester.
The second tool that you suggest in your book is called pressure-free estimating. Pressure-free estimating, what is that?
It builds on a very old method that many project managers know from the PIMBO guide and from other sources. That's three-point estimation. It was part of the PERT, Program Evaluation and Review Technique method, which was developed in the late 1950s, early 1960s in combination with the Polaris program. It's not a new method, but I add a little thing, which is psychology. It's interesting if you combine this with psychology. I think a big art in project management is to reduce pressure on people, but at the same time increase the perception of urgency of work that needed to be finished or of other things. So the art is to make things urgent without putting pressure on people. If you put pressure on people, you will not really know what's going on in your organization or in your project. People will hide things from you, will cover things from you. Again, there is a very, very recent example on that, and that's the situation at Volkswagen, where they had a software abused, which is helpful to prepare an engine for testbed tests, and this was used to cheat emission testing. It wasn't made for that, but someone had this idea. And Volkswagen say, the management of Volkswagen say, they didn't know that and they were surprised by themselves. And I think they are absolutely right. I know the company. I've known it for many, many decades, meanwhile. And there's an old saying in Volkswagen, if Volkswagen knew what Volkswagen knows. Yeah, so this comes from pressure. There was a lot of pressure on people. Volkswagen always was a high-pressure organization. So take pressure from people to get better estimates, to better know what is going on in your project, to take politics out of the estimating, because you don't want political estimates. What you want is just estimates. Take pressure from people. But at the same time, keep the perception of urgency. And that's really an art to do that. Most people think pressure and urgency come together, and often they come together, of course, yeah? But to trying to separate those two so that you get a fast-working team, fast-working project, and you still know what's going on in that. I think that's a big art here, and that's what pressure-free estimating is about. It's a combination of three-point estimation and a bit of psychology.
The third tool is called Protective Change Request Management Process. Protective Change Request Management Process. What is this process about, Oliver?
We see very often in projects that healthy projects get damaged by bad management of change requests. Change requests are a very interesting thing because they have two sides. They have a friendly side for the project manager. If you have a project in troubles, maybe in crisis, intelligent change requests may help you bring the project out of this crisis. Actually, that's the basic idea of benefit engineering that we discussed earlier, to use the change request management process for that. If you have a project in crisis, take it out of it. But at the same time, if you manage them badly, they can bring your project into crisis. So what you need to do is to protect your project from that. And it may sound a bit strange, but a bit of bureaucracy on change requests can be very, very helpful to separate the valuable and the interesting and the good and the constructive changes from those that are rather detrimental and that do not bring a benefit to the project and to the organization and to everything. So that's what it is about. In essence, it's a very simple thing. If you run a customer project and your internal sponsor approaches you and says, you were planned, you were budgeted with $2 million to run this project for the customer. I know you are the project manager. You can do it also for $1.5 million. I know you can save the money for us so that we have a bit more profit at the end of the year. Situation many project managers know in customer projects. The response here is very simple. You open the drawer of your desk, you take the change request form out and you talk to your boss and say, no problem at all, no problem. Please fill in the change request form and we will check that. You need a very strong process and very strong stance to do this with your boss, but it's the right way to do it, yeah, to protect your project. If it's possible, we can do it. If it's not possible, we cannot do it. We have a contract with a customer. And we cannot run into a breach of contract situation.
Hmm? So we've had benefit engineering. That was the first one. Pressure-free estimating was second. Protective change request management process. We just heard about that. And then the fourth and final tool we want to review is called situational project scheduling. How do I do that?
This goes back to what I said earlier, to this navigating between two monsters. We have two extreme approaches to project management today. One approach is the agile approach, which assumes that in a project, the way is made by walking. We have, on the other extreme side, a predictive approach to project management. We have waterfall models. By the way, on both sides, we have ideologies as well. I call them agilists and predictivists. Agilists say it's only us, the agile world and the waterfall and the predictive world. And the predictive world is bad because they have command and control and a lot of pressure on people and so on. The predictive world says about the agile world, how can they run projects if they don't know how activities relate with each other? They don't know anything about dependencies between activities and they have no workflow planned and so on and so on. If we just ignore the ideologies for a moment, I think ideologies in project management are generally bad. Somewhere in between is a path. It's actually the path of the PIMBO guide. It's between those two extremes. If you follow this path somewhere in the middle, if you have some ability to adjust your behavior, you just look at your project and say, okay, I'm in a situation where I have to be a bit more agile. We do some creative work maybe, or we do some basic research where the way is made by walking. We cannot say for sure what we are going to do in 4 weeks' time or in 8 weeks' time because we need results first before we can make such decisions. So in such a situation, you would rather go for a more agile way. In another moment in the same project possibly, you have to plan long-term in advance because you have to book people. You have to order certain deliveries that take a lot of time to be made and to be finished for you. So you have to do long-term predictions. Then you turn more to the other side. You are prepared to go more to the agile or more to the predictive side depending on the situation of your project.
All right. Thank you very much for the review of those four tools. I'd now like to turn the focus on you yourself, you personally. I have two questions for you. First of all, when was the last time that you applied situational awareness of your projects. How did that go?
As I say, I think we somehow do it all the time. I think it's mm-hmm. something we do anyway. We're maybe not aware of it, or we don't have a methodological foundation for that. We just do it because it is part of our professionalism. And I'm running some projects mainly with the PMI Munich chapter, which I preside. I'm not really the project manager in them, but I'm part of their stakeholder groups of change control boards. So I think I'm situational there all the time. I look at the people I'm with. They are all volunteers. It's like having workers who are expected to do overtime work, but they are not getting paid any regular income. So it's the unpaid overtime work and nothing else. You have to keep these people motivated. You have to give them joy in the things they do. You have to respect them with their own areas of decision making and so on. And they may need certain help, and different people need different kinds of respect, different kinds of help, different kinds of how you build teams there maybe. So I think there are many, many situations that need a very adjusted and very adapted approach to them. And that's something we all have every day.
And how do you know that you are doing things right? I mean, it's one thing to see a situation has changed and I now have to come up with a situational response, or I have to change the plan. But how do you make sure yourself that the particular response that you have developed is the right response for the situation that's at hand?
One thing is experience, and one thing mm-hmm. is I have some knowledge developed based on some research in here together with a group of field experts, 17 field experts, all together, I think over 350 years of experience or so collected, people who have a bit of distant view to project management. They are not active project managers. They are more from PMOs, from magazines. There was a blogger with them. There were some trainer colleagues of mine who all have a view on project management, which with some distance, so they can compare projects, and they don't have too much passion in the project, but then they know what's going on. They see what's going on. And it's interesting. I ask them simply, if you take certain types of projects, what do you think? What approach is most helpful there? We looked in two dimensions. One dimension is leadership styles. It's called actually achieving styles, developed by an American professor, Jean Lipman Blumen. She developed the model some years ago that we are applying. And the other thing is this question between agility and predictiveness and something in the middle. We call this in the middle, by the way, a rolling wave approach between agile and long-term predictions, which is the best for a given situation or for a given type of situation or of project. The difficulty for that, to develop that, what I needed to develop is a project typology, which I also did together with these experts. And it was a very interesting exercise with them. No one has yet done that. No one has ever developed a typology of projects. And we found a lot of interesting, we don't have the time here to discuss all these details, yeah? But we found a lot of interconnectivity between project types and certain approaches and certain behaviors. And I think we can give very practical help here. If you see that your project is of a certain type, don't be too predictive, or don't be too agile, or don't be too competitive, or whatever it is, too aggressive maybe. Yeah, we can give some help on that. Mm-hmm. But again, it's the question of favorability or of what is detrimental, possibly detrimental to the project. Whether it's really the right approach, there will never be 100% knowledge on that before the task is done. When the task is done, then you will know whether your approach was right or wrong. Looking into the future is always uncertain. Yeah? The bad thing about the future
very
is
difficult.
It hasn't happened yet. Yeah? From hindsight, things are always much, much easier. But I think the typology is very, very helpful. Let me give you an example on this typology thing. If you think of burns, it's a very bad thing to have a burn, or and each burn is different. If people have accidents, the burns are very, very different. But in medicine, they developed a classification system for burns, with three classes and some subclasses. In essence, it's five classes with all the subclasses in. And now it's much more easy. It's much easier to help people in such a situation, because they know there are certain first degree burns. That's something you can treat at home. You still need a doctor. By the way, always take a doctor and don't rely on Oliver Lehmann when it comes to burns. Rely on the doctor. But in class, in class one, burns are very, they're not that dangerous, and you may have to spend some time at home. You need your doctor. If you have third degree burns, and some even have fifth degree, when bones are burned and when your muscles are burned as well, then you have to spend a long time in the hospital and find help in the hospital. So they can give a staged approach to dealing burns, which are very, very different. And that's about the same approach that I try to do here. Develop a typology which helps us to understand certain project situations.
One typology I'd like to talk about is small, medium, and large projects. Do we as project managers require a different type of situational awareness and situational project management on these small, medium, and large projects? Is anything that we do different?
Yeah, possibly. Interesting. The typology that I developed is an open typology. So we have now 9 dimensions, and they were created by asking questions. I asked my experts who know many, many projects from their work today, but also from their history. And all of them have been practicing project managers before, so they know exactly what they are talking about. I asked them, do you remember a situation that a certain approach, a behavior, a practice that was successful in one situation failed in another one? I tried to get their memories working on such situations like this, the Berlin and Stuttgart main station that I talked about earlier. And they all gave me at least one, some had more than 3 examples for such situations where they were surprised by that. None of them discussed the topic of small, medium, and large. They came with completely different questions. One typology or one dimension inside the typology, for instance, is we try to find some names for that are easy to understand. We call them Mark 1 and Mark N projects. You may know this from cameras or from British broadcasts, where you have a Mark 2 and a Mark 3 and Mark 4. That's just generation. So a Mark 1 project, you do something for the first time. You have no experience with that. Your team has no experience. Maybe it's just completely new, or it may not be new, but the team has never done that before. It's new to the team. This would be a Mark 1 project and a Mark N project. We have done something similar in the past, and this was something where the same approach that was successful in one type was not successful in the other one. By the way, the interesting thing, and that's absolutely new, it would be interesting to see more research on that, because the numbers are too small to make a statistic statement out of that. But the interesting thing was there were more problems reported with Mark N projects, where people know what they are doing, than with Mark 1 projects. I think it's about complacency. In a Mark 1 project, you're never complacent. In a Mark N project, people may become complacent. And then a very little thing, a very little problem somewhere overlooked, and no one really took care of that, grew to a huge explosion, became some kind of a time bomb in that. And that's an interesting. So we have some other dimensions in here. And small and large may be a valid typological differentiation, but it's not discussed in the book because it did not turn up with my experts.
Okay. Many of our listeners, they're probably managing multiple projects at the same time. How much are situational awareness and situational project management related to our ability as project managers to successfully lead multiple projects at the same time?
There are 2 aspects on that. First of all, multiple projects often means very small projects. So your small and large may be a part of that. It may also mean that you have high competition between projects regarding resources in use, and the project manager is a resource, by the way. The project manager is one of the most important resources in a project. So there's competition between the projects on the various resources, including the project measures. I think this is something that's interesting to look at. In my book, I could not look at that from a simple reason. This is more the typology of the environment in which the project works. I would love very much to find some students who want to do some research in typology of project environments. You cannot do research on everything. You have to limit the things that you do research on. And my interest at this time was in developing a typology of projects and then identify practices that are favorable or detrimental for them. But I think there is another big aspect, and that's the project environment. So what you're talking about, I would see it more as a question on the project environment than on the project itself. But there's another interesting point. One of my typological dimensions is this distinction between customer projects and internal projects. I think it's the most obvious distinction for everyone. And it's interesting, if you look into literature, almost no one really makes this distinction. You don't find literature on the differences between internal projects and customer projects. And these differences are huge. They are really huge. Internal projects are commonly run in a weak matrix. Project managers have a bad reputation in average, not in every organization, not in every situation, but often they have a fairly bad reputation because they don't get the resources they need. They don't bring money home. They have a cost center, not a profit center. Someone else earns the money, so the other one will have the resources and not the project. This makes projects late, makes it difficult to supply and to deliver all the things that the project needs to deliver. In a customer project, project managers are far more powerful and in their own organization, they bring the money home, they make the profit, they run a profit center, and their appreciation and their reputation is often, not always, but often much, much better than in internal projects. And the interesting thing about this, having many projects at a time, you find this for a given size of project, hard to measure, by the way, but for a given size of project, you find that in internal projects, project managers are often expected to run two or three projects of a certain size, where in a customer project environment, it would be very, very clear this project manager looks only for one project, has only one project, has not much additional work to do, yeah, operational things, day-by-day work. They get very much released from that to focus very much on the project. At about the same size, where in an internal project, project managers are still expected to do many things at the same time. Yeah? So the resource sharing is much stronger in these internal projects. What you describe is a problem, not with very small projects, but with the average size of projects. It's much more a problem for internal projects than for customer projects. So it's back. We are back to my typology.
So far, we've only talked about the project manager and how we use situational awareness and situational project management. What about all other stakeholders that are involved on our project team members, sponsors, or all those other persons that are involved? Do they need situational awareness as well?
They need it as much as the project managers need it, because the project managers need their support. They must understand that the sponsor, for instance, or a customer must understand if they come with a change request, if they come with certain requirements on reporting, on the way people communicate with them, report things to them. This will all have a certain influence on project success. And they must understand that they also have to balance things out, and they have to navigate between two monsters. One monster is not enough reporting, so they don't know what's going on in the project they sponsor, or too much reporting, which means the project manager and the team do not have enough time to just do their work and be successful in the project. It's another example of this navigating between two monsters, too much reporting or not enough reporting. Somewhere between the two is the correct way, the good way. And this way may not be the same during the course of the project. At some times you need more reporting and more communications, more meetings, yeah, and so on. And in others you may need less than that. Yeah. So yes, of course they need this as well.
All right. And here is my final question for you, Oliver. Let's help our listeners to improve how they handle those moments when situational awareness is required. So please tell us, what are the 3 to 4 questions that a project manager should ask herself, himself, when they see that they need right now situational awareness or situational project management in order to respond to changing circumstances? What are the things that you ask yourself when something happens?
I think the first question is, what is the situation? What is the situation that I'm in? What is the project? What is the situation inside the project? What is maybe also the project environment? What are the requirements of them on me as a project manager, or on me as a trainer, as a project sponsor, some other important stakeholder in the project? I think that's the first question. Then the second question is, can I explain my behavior? Can I, if someone would ask me to write down why do I behave the way I behave, can I really say that? Am I able to explain that, or am I just behaving as I behaved all the time? Yeah? Maybe I have a day, I had some conflict with people, and I feel very angry. And by the way, have you ever noticed that angry people are unable to develop empathy for others? Yeah? So I don't have empathy at the moment, but I can't really explain why I don't have empathy. It's just that I'm so angry on someone. So at the moment that you have to describe your behavior and the causes of the behavior and the purpose of your behavior, maybe just to yourself, you lose this angriness and you get some distance to yourself, and you ask yourself, why do I behave like that? And then I think the third question should be, is this behavior that I at the very moment have and that I show to others, and the practices and the approaches that I'm using, are they really compliant to the needs of the project and of law and of my boss and of the customer and all the others? Or could it be that there is some discrepancy between what I do and the way I do things and the needs of the given situation?
Thank you. And for those of you who really want to dig deep into this topic, then I would like to recommend you that the book is titled Situational Project Management: The Dynamics of Success and Failure. The author is, of course, Oliver Lehmann, and it is published by CRC Press. Oliver, vielen Dank für dieses ausgezeichnete Interview.
Hat Spaß gemacht. Dankeschön.
Dankeschön. Tschüss.
Ciao. Goodbye.
And that was our very situational interview with Oliver Lehmann. If you are a project manager who wants to become PMP or PMI ACP certified, then the easiest way to do so is with our sister podcasts, the Project Management Prepcast or the Agile Prepcast, and study for the exam by watching the in-depth exam video training from pmprepcast.com. And that's it. Thank you very much for listening. As always, you can find us on the web at pm-podcast.com. Please send your emails to info@pm-podcast.com. And for the very last time, when you write, please do tell me where in the world you are writing from. And finally, we have this. Project management methodologies are like a four-wheel drive for business. They allow you to get stuck in more remote places. Until next time.